on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, marking Memorial Day weekend by learning about one of the nearly 8,000 Americans still unaccounted for from the Korean War, one of more than 5,000 still missing on the North Korean side of the demilitarized zone established on July 27, 1953, with the signing of the armistice. Jet fighter pilot Jimmy Escal was shot down a little more than a month before that, on June 19th. Our guest is that pilot's nephew, born 6 years after he went missing and named in his honor. Jim Escal has shared with us how he first learned that he even had an uncle when he was eight, how finding a photo in his parents' dresser sparked a quest that you can read about in the book Unforgotten Hero, Remembering a Fighter Pilot's Life, War, and Ultimate Sacrifice. I have a link to it at hometownheroesradio.com. And some of the things you'll find in the book are letters written before and after the decorated pilot's disappearance, letters that may yield some clues to his ultimate fate. Jim, can you share a couple of those with us?
Well, the first thing I have is the letter his flight leader sent to my grandparents a few days after my uncle disappeared. Dear Mr. and Mrs. Escal, we of Mike Flight feel that you are wondering about the details of the flight on which your son Jimmy became missing in action. With hopes that this might be your wish, I shall endeavor to give you the information in a brief form. On June 19, Jim was flying an armored reconnaissance patrol on a main supply route some 30 miles deep in enemy territory. The purpose of this mission was to seek enemy vehicles along the route and destroy them. During the patrol, Jim spotted a group of trucks and with his wingman began strafing passes on them. Since he and his wingman were making their passes in opposite directions to avoid as much anti-aircraft fire as possible, they lost visual contact with each other and maintained their relative positions to the trucks by radio calls. Jim called that he was going in on a second pass, so the wingman remained high, waiting for the call that Jim was off his target. When this call did not come for several seconds, the wingman began his second pass, having decided that Jim was already off. Upon pulling off the target, the wingman called Jim for his position, but received no answer. He then began circling the immediate area looking for Jim and calling him repeatedly from the radio. After considerable time in circling, calling, receiving no answer or sight of Jim, the wingman had to return home due to low fuel. When the wingman arrived at the base with his report, a flight was immediately sent back to the area to search. This flight searched over the entire area of the target and soon spotted the smoking wreckage of an aircraft a few miles south of the target. Since no sight was made of Jim and no radio calls were received from him, it is quite possible that he may have had to bail out in a hurry with no time for calls. However, in all honesty to you, chances are against this possibility. As flight commander of Mike Flight, I quickly found that Jim was one of our better pilots soon after his arrival here. I might add that as an officer and a buddy, he was one of the squadron's most popular men. His absence is well felt among us all. We all join with you in hopes and prayers that he will rejoin us again.
The first time you read that, you must have had goosebumps.
Oh, yeah. That got to me.
And if I'm hearing that correctly, he was basically saying it's possible that he bailed out, but more likely that he went into the ground and died.
Yeah, more likely he did than bail out.
Unfortunately, that letter right there contains more information than anything else ever really gave you about those circumstances, right?
It's basically a summary of what happened.
Because no one can get in there and do more investigation, you really don't have much other than that, other than they identified the plane with the tail number.
That's it. It's a locked door, basically. You can't get in the room.
You also have a letter from your Uncle Jim. And again, here you start this quest trying to learn about a guy who you never even knew existed until you find this photo. I imagine reading the words that he actually wrote had to be pretty meaningful.
Well, yes, it did. He wrote a letter the day before he became MIA. He wrote it to my father, who was at Nellis Air Force Base, going through his gunnery training. And he says, 18 June 53, 0830. Hello there. Well, I'm AO today, so I finally found time to get off a couple letters. Hope you're flying by now. I bet you and G know Vegas pretty well by now. Hope you don't have to come over here, Bob. It would be better if you could stay in the States. If you went to Europe, it would be nice. I imagine you have been reading the papers about the big push the Chinese have made on our lines. I don't know how big they said it was, but it is big. The day it started, they had us in the air before the sun was up, and we didn't land until 9 o'clock that night. I got 4 missions that day, and I was so tired I could just walk, but it was fun. We kept this up for 2 days, and then the weather came in. I got 11 missions in 3 days. The day before the push started, I got 3 missions, and for the next 2 days, I got 4 missions each day. On the day I got 3, I had an interesting day. Our first mission that morning was a dive bombing mission on troops and supplies. We really plastered that target. The second mission was a Yalu River sweep. On this sweep, we climbed to 40,000 feet and dropped our tanks. Then we climbed up to 48,000 feet and started patrolling the Yalu River. We had just started west on our patrol when 10 MiGs came right across our nose. They were going in just the opposite direction as we were. By this time, we turned. They were way out in front of us. We finally had to break it off for the they were patrolling a certain area. If we could have seen them a little sooner, we might have gotten a head-on shot or got on their tail sooner. Anyway, I have seen MiGs. Ha. I hope we can go on some more of those missions. When I dropped my tanks, it rolled out the wing and tore the pitot tube off. And then my radio went out, so I really had an interesting Yalu sweep. I had to make a formation landing due to the airspeed being out. Then the third mission that day was a skip bombing mission on a dam about 50 miles from Antung. We came in about 15 to 20 feet off the deck and bombed the dam. So that was an interesting mission. Next day, the big push started, and we were hitting the front line just as the sun came up. The T-6 directs us on these type of missions. The sky was full of 86s, 84s, Navy, Marine planes. We bombed the Chinese all day and after dark. After dark, we went down road behind the lines and shot up trucks. The flak was really heavy for those 2 days. We lost 3 F-86s from our group during these 2 days due to the ground fire. The sky was almost full of flak. After dark, you could see the tracers. It looked like a 4th of July in the late evening. There were lots of trucks moving up the front after dark. Boy, as soon as you would start down for the trucks, they would open up from both sides of the valley. We really worked for those 3 days, and I think we helped the soldiers a lot. Right after dark, you could see how hard their fighting was by all the flashes. Everyone still thinks the truce will be signed. The Chinese are just trying to get some good hills right now. Well, enough on the war. I'll write you some if I get some interesting missions. I have 40 missions now. Hurrah. We finally got a good night's sleep and a bath after 3 days due to the weather last night. I don't know how long it'll take for that present to get there. Well, I better get back to work. Tell everyone hello. Hey, on the first day of that big push, my squadron set a group, wing, and 5th Air Force record for sorties. We got 121 that day. Those crew chiefs and armament men really worked hard for us to set that record. Have fun. So long. Jim.
It's quite a treasure.
You learn quite a bit from these letters.
That probably tells you more than anything else you ever found.
You get a visual look. You just imagine what this scenario looks like by reading that.
Well, and because he's never been found, because he can't talk to you now, this was written a day before he disappeared.
Yep.
And don't you feel like in that letter, even though he didn't know what was going to happen the next day, he's given you a lot of clues to what did happen?
Yep.
When he talks about the anti-aircraft fire and how thick it was and how hard these guys are working to fly so many missions in so short a time.
It kind of puts a scenario in front of you visually. You could imagine in your mind what the scenario looks like.
The other thing that hit me, one of the first things he said in that letter, what did he say to your father?
I hope you don't have to come over here. I hope you can stay in the States. He knew the situation over there, how dangerous it was.
What year were you born?
I was born in 1959, 6 years after he disappeared.
So when you read that line, I hope you don't have to come over here, Bob.
And he wanted to. My dad wanted to go to Korea. But he emphasized, stay there if you can.
Because if your dad had gone over there and suffered the same fate.
It's happened others, I've heard.
You wouldn't be here.
No, I wouldn't. Yeah, that's true. They eventually, my dad even petitioned the Air Force to be sent to Korea after the armistice. He still wanted to go there. But they said, okay, we don't need pilots there anymore. We're going to send you where we send you.
I want to ask you a question. And I don't know if it's fair to ask. It's probably a real tough one. But again, reading that letter, hearing you read that letter, written a day before he disappeared, and we talked about the different clues, and he has that haunting line to your dad, I hope you don't have to come over here.
He repeats that in about 3 of his letters.
So he keeps telling him that. I hope you don't have to come over here. He's telling him how crazy and intense these missions have been, flying 15 to 20 feet off the ground in anti-aircraft fire so thick that other planes are going down every time. Do you think he knew that something was going to happen to them?
Oh, they knew the possibilities every day. They can go on a mission, never come back. Because they were fighter-bomber pilots. They were just low to the ground. So they knew the possible circumstances each time they went on a mission. So that's why he was trying to, I think he's trying to warn my dad.
That's incredible. And before we got into the letters, you spoke to the mystery that remains. Since North Korea is closed off and no conclusive evidence has been found, there are several possible realities.
Clearly, you've considered all these possibilities, and I'm sure there's part of you that dreams that he did survive. But then when you think about that, how hard is it to imagine that he could be alive for some time after this happened and have no way of connecting at all with any kind of family or anyone back home?
Yeah, my grandmother thought about that especially, because she died, unfortunately, she died as well. My grandfather died without knowing what happened to their son, as in many cases, that's what happens. And it just kind of heartfelt, you know, if he's in captivity, what is his daily life like? You know, is he eating? Is he being tortured? What the deal was? We don't have no clue. So it's difficult.
So at this point, this is still a mystery. And for so many other American families, they have that same mystery, a loved one who was never brought back. There are these kind of cases in World War II and in Vietnam, but Korea kind of takes it to another level because that territory has never been opened back up because of the way that war ended, and North Korea has remained the way it is. So when you look ahead and you allow yourself to hope, because obviously you had to have some belief throughout this thing to accomplish what you've done and to fill in so many blanks about your uncle's story, I'm sure that's added a lot to your life to know all of this, right?
Yes, it has. Quite a bit.
But I'm sure there's still something out there that you dream about and you think this would be the closure or the full circle, the ending, a new epilogue to this book that would really add something. So when you allow yourself to think about those things, what is it that you would like to see happen?
I'd like to be able to see North Korea open their doors and allow countries like ours to go in there and to search, like they do in Vietnam. We should be able allowed to go into North Korea and be able to search, you know, for our lost ones that are buried somewhere. And hopefully that'd be the case in the future.
Why did you want to write the book? You talked about your fascination with your uncle from the time you saw that photo when you were 8 years old. But what was it that convinced you know what, I need to put this together in a book?
It was a culmination of all the information I was able to gather over the years. And one of the squadron mates in Korea said, you know, you need to write a book. It's not just your uncle's story. It's our story. It's every person, especially the Air Force who went over there to Korea, fought in Korea, and especially for those who never came home. It's their story as well. You need to share it with everybody.
And I'm sure it was a lot of work.
Oh, it was a lot of work. A lot of research.
Was it worth it?
Oh, yeah. I believe so.
What has made it worth it? Can you give us an example of some feedback you got? I know there's some fantastic quotes on the back jacket of your book from some high-ranking Air Force officers who talk about what they got out of it and what it means to them. But what's been the most meaningful feedback that you've received since writing the book?
I think the way I could help other people, that I was looking for information, I was able to match people that haven't seen each other for 50 years. So that helped me, knowing these pilots who didn't see each other for 50 years could get reunited. They get their interest back, learn their history. Because some people don't even remember. They didn't even remember. They said, oh, yeah, did that take place? I didn't recall. It must have happened. So, you know, it's a teaching experience, basically. So I was thrilled with that. So I was able to help others at the same time I was trying to help myself.
And it's amazing when you really seek to help others how much you end up benefiting in the long run, isn't it?
Yes, sure is.
I bet you've learned a lot about the Korean War.
I've learned quite a bit. I didn't even know where Korea was. When I was 8 years old and started, I had never heard of Korea. I was doing a lot of World War II. I was always in the library getting books about World War II. I could go to Iwo Jima, Okinawa, and all those places like in Europe. I had never heard of Korea. So it was fascinating to learn all this stuff. And I'm still learning, by the way.
Yeah, and you mentioned right off the bat, it's known as the Forgotten War. And you have a reason to make sure it isn't forgotten. And you've preserved your uncle's memory. You've uncovered your uncle's story and preserved it and shared it with so many people through the writing of this book. So for those people who really don't know much about the Korean War, what are the things that you hope, for your uncle's sake and to honor his legacy, that people do understand and remember about that time in our country's history?
Well, one good evidence is just look at South Korea. I mean, they're just a well-built society. And compare that with how North Korea is. People say that, you know, we lost, like a Korean War was the first we lost before even Vietnam. But actually, we didn't lose. We maintained their democratic way of life, basically.
Yeah, so, don't go to South Korea and say you lost, because they'll show you how much they appreciate it.
No, the South Korean, they just love America. They love, and the veteran especially.
I'm sure you've seen it. I think every Korean War vet I've spoken to over the years has pointed out those nighttime photographs from space of the Korean Peninsula.
Yeah.
South Korea is
all lit up.
And North Korea?
Dark.
Yeah, nothing.
Nothing.
But somewhere in that darkness, somewhere in that black section of the map, is probably your uncle.
Somewhere, someplace.
Are you ever going to stop trying to find out where he is and the full story of what happened?
No, we never stop. There's no end. There won't be end to the until his remains are found, brought back. Then I could write another conclusion or another epilogue to the story. One part of writing it is hoping other people will copy what I'm doing. They don't have to write a book, but just to, if you have a relative that's been missing or lost or maybe killed in a war, to get as much information as you can on them. Don't have them as a statistic, as a number, but they have a life. Remember how they live, not so much how they died, but how they live and who they were and what they did for this country.
Yes, well said. And when we come back, we're going to hear from a man who might be able to help you find what you're looking for. He's done that for over 1,000 families. But thank you, Jim Escal. What a tremendous tribute to your Uncle Jimmy you've put together in your book, Unforgotten Hero. Go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and info on the book. You're also going to find a link to the work of World War II researcher Bill Beagle. And we'll meet Bill when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.